A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been digging into airline fleet strategy. Why some carriers go all in on one manufacturer, why others fly a mix, and what's really driving those decisions. He's looking at LL, which is conspicuously all Boeing, despite being a small tech-forward airline that modifies its planes with missile defense systems nobody else uses. He's asking whether that's about intergovernmental agreements, ties to the Israeli Air Force, or something else entirely. And then there's the flip side. Delta, an airline that practically oozes Americana, flying Airbuses. He wants to know how mixed fleet operators even manage the training and maintenance nightmare, and whether the industry as a whole is trending towards standardization or away from it.
This is one of those topics where the surface answer is simple and the real answer is fascinating. Every aircraft type you add to your fleet multiplies complexity across the entire operation. Separate type ratings for pilots, separate maintenance certifications for mechanics, separate spare parts inventories, separate simulators. A single type fleet is the operational holy grail. And yet, when you look at the world's largest airlines, they're almost all flying a mix.
So the people with the most to gain from standardization are the ones rejecting it.
The people with the most to gain from standardization are the ones who can afford to reject it. That's the paradox. The cost of diversification is real and substantial, but for the biggest carriers, it's outweighed by two things: the ability to match specific aircraft to specific routes, and the procurement leverage you get from playing Boeing and Airbus against each other.
So the question isn't which strategy is better. It's how big do you need to be before diversification stops being a burden and starts being a weapon?
Let's put some numbers on the burden first. A pilot type rating costs somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 per pilot. A full flight simulator runs $10 to $15 million. And those are just the upfront costs. Every additional type means another set of simulators, another training pipeline, another group of pilots who can only fly that specific family.
And that's before you get to the parts inventory.
The parts problem is almost worse because it's ongoing. Every aircraft type has its own ecosystem of components. Different engines, different landing gear, different avionics. You need to stock spares for each type, train mechanics on each type's procedures, maintain separate tooling. Even ground equipment is different. Tow bars, GPU adapters, they're manufacturer specific.
So Southwest is the obvious example of doing it the simple way.
Southwest is the canonical case. All Boeing's 737 fleet for decades. Hundreds of aircraft, one type. Every pilot can fly every plane. Every mechanic can work on every plane. One simulator bay, one parts inventory, one set of ground equipment. The operational efficiency is enormous. And they've been so committed to it that when the 737 MAX was grounded, they didn't have any other type to fall back on. They just had to wait it out. That's the risk of the single type strategy. You're all in on one manufacturer's timeline.
And yet the big legacy carriers, Delta, American, United, they're all mixed.
Heavily mixed. Delta operates Boeing 717s, 737s, 757s, 777s, and 777s alongside Airbus A20s, A39s, A320s, 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 A330s, and A370s. That's nine types across two manufacturers. American and United are similarly split. And these aren't small fleets. Delta has over 900 aircraft.
So what's the argument for that? If standardization saves so much money, why do the biggest carriers run the most complex operations?
Two main reasons, and they're both about competitive advantage. The first is route-specific economics. Different aircraft are optimal for different missions. The A321XLR can do thin transatlantic routes that a 737 can't reach profitably. The 787 is brilliant for medium-density long-haul. The A220 is perfect for regional routes where a 737 is too much airplane. If you're an airline with a global network and diverse route links, being locked into one manufacturer's catalog means you're flying suboptimal aircraft on some routes.
So you're paying more in operational complexity to pay less per seat mile on each individual route.
That's the trade-off. And the second reason is procurement leverage. If you're an all-Boeing airline, Boeing knows you have nowhere else to go. Your negotiating position is terrible. But if you're Delta and you're about to order 100 narrowbodies, both Boeing and Airbus know you could go either way. That competition drives down prices. Some analysts estimate the discount from competitive bidding can be 10 to 15%, which, on a 100 aircraft order, is real money.
So the mixed fleet isn't a burden. It's a negotiating tool that pays for itself.
At scale, yes. And there's a middle ground that a lot of airlines use, commonality within families. You standardize on a single family, say all A320neo variants, or all 737 MAX variants, and you capture most of the training and parts efficiency while still getting some route flexibility. One type rating covers all of them. Pilots can move between variants with minimal additional training.
So Ryanair and EasyJet, one's all. Boeing, one's all. Airbus, but they're both basically doing the same thing.
They're low-cost carriers with simple point-to-point networks. They don't need diverse aircraft because they don't fly diverse routes. Ryanair is all 737s, EasyJet is all A320 family. The standardization makes perfect sense for their business model. It's the legacy carriers with hub and spoke systems and global networks that need the flexibility.
Which brings us to LL. Small fleet, roughly 45 aircraft. But not a low-cost carrier, not a simple network, and definitely not a normal airline. All Boeing. Why?
The answer starts in the 1970s. Before that, El Al actually operated a mix. They had British and French aircraft alongside Boeings. But in the 70s, they standardized on Boeing, and once you're in that ecosystem, switching costs become enormous. For a small airline, they're potentially crippling.
But that's true of any small airline that's standardized. What makes LL different is what they do to their planes.
Right. LL equips its fleet with the C-Music system, commercial multispectral infrared countermeasure. It's a directed infrared countermeasure system that uses lasers to jam heat-seeking missiles. This isn't a bolt-on accessory. It's integrated into the aircraft's structure and avionics. The system detects a missile launch, tracks the threat, and fires a laser to confuse the missile's guidance system, all automatically, in fractions of a second.
And nobody else does this to commercial aircraft.
Not at this level. Some government VIP aircraft have similar systems, but El Al is the only commercial airline that's installed directed infrared countermeasures across its fleet. The system was developed by Israel Aerospace Industries, working closely with El Al and the Israeli Air Force. And this is where the Boeing connection becomes structural rather than historical.
Because you can't just install a laser-based missile jammer on a commercial airliner without the manufacturer's cooperation.
You absolutely cannot. The C-Music system needs to interface with the aircraft's flight control computers, its power systems, its sensor suite. The integration work requires access to proprietary systems and source code. Boeing has been working with the Israelis on defense modifications since the 707 days. There's a decades-long engineering relationship there. The trust, the technical familiarity, the established certification pathways, all of that's Boeing-specific.
And Airbus presumably looks at this and says, no thank you.
It's not even necessarily that Airbus would refuse. It's that the certification process would be starting from zero. Every modification LL makes to its aircraft has to be certified by both the FAA and the Civil Aviation Authority of Israel. Doing that on a Boeing platform where there's 30-plus years of precedent and an established working relationship between Boeing, IAI, and the regulators, that's manageable. Doing it on an Airbus platform, where none of those relationships exist, and Airbus would need to release proprietary technical data to a foreign defense establishment. That's a multi-year, multi-hundred-million-dollar project with no guarantee of success.
And there's the Israeli Air Force connection.
That's the other piece. El Al's aircraft have been used as backup military transports in emergencies. Operation Solomon in 1991, the airlift of Ethiopian Jews to Israel, used El Al aircraft alongside IAF planes. The IAF operates Boeing platforms, KC-707 tankers, 707-based surveillance aircraft. There's commonality in maintenance knowledge and spare parts between El Al's fleet and the IAF's Boeings. that intergovernmental relationship creates a de facto preference for Boeing that goes beyond any formal agreement.
So it's not. Israel buys Boeing because America is our ally. It's El Al buys Boeing because Boeing is the only manufacturer that's already inside the tent on the defense modifications.
The geopolitics matter, but they're downstream of the engineering reality. The U.S.-Israel relationship creates the conditions where Boeing is willing to share technical data with Israeli defense contractors. But the actual decision to stay all, Boeing is driven by the prohibitive cost of recertifying every modification on a new platform.
Which brings us to the other outlier, Delta, the most American of airlines, flying Airbuses. What's the story there?
The story starts with a merger. In 2008, Delta acquired Northwest Airlines. Northwest had a large Airbus fleet, A319s, A320s, A330s. Delta didn't go out and buy Airbuses because they wanted to. They inherited them.
And they could have sold them.
They could have. But selling dozens of aircraft at once, especially during the financial crisis, would have meant taking a massive loss. And once they were operating the Airbus fleet, they discovered something. On certain routes, the Airbus aircraft were better than the Boeing alternatives. The A-13er, for example, was more efficient on specific transatlantic routes than the 767s Delta was flying.
So, pragmatism over patriotism.
Completely. And it went further. Delta eventually ordered the A220, originally the Bombardier C-Series, before Airbus bought the program, because it offered better economics on regional routes than anything Boeing had in that size class. And they've ordered the A320 for routes where the 737 MAX wasn't the optimal choice. Delta's fleet decisions are driven entirely by route-level unit cost. The brand image doesn't enter into it.
Which is itself a very American approach, if you think about it. The market decides.
In Delta's scale, over 900 aircraft means they can absorb the complexity of a mixed fleet in a way that a smaller airline can't. They use a fleet-specific maintenance model, mechanics are certified on specific types, and assigned to hangars that handle those types. Pilots are qualified on one family at a time, Boeing narrowbody or Airbus widebody, and bid for schedules accordingly. The airline maintains separate training pipelines, simulators, and parts depots for each manufacturer.
So the key variable really is scale. Below a certain fleet size, the overhead of multiple types eats you alive. Above it, the route optimization and procurement leverage more than pay for the complexity.
That's the core insight, and it explains why the industry isn't trending in one direction. The low-cost carriers are standardizing. Ryanair, EasyJet, Southwest, they're all single-type or single-family. The big legacy carriers are maintaining or even expanding their mix. And the small full-service carriers, like El Al, tend to standardize. But for reasons that are often more about history and specific operational requirements than about a generic preference for simplicity.
The other thing that keeps coming up is lock-in. Once you're in one manufacturer's ecosystem, switching is enormously expensive. So airlines tend to add new types only when they're expanding into a new market segment, not when they're replacing existing planes.
Right. If you're replacing 737s, you buy more 737s or the MAX because the switching costs are so high. But if you're launching a new ultra-long-haul route that your current fleet can't serve, that's when you might bring in a new type from a different manufacturer. It's not about replacing what you have, it's about filling gaps.
And that's exactly how Delta's Airbus fleet grew. They didn't replace Boeings with Airbuses. They kept the Boeings and added Airbuses for routes where the Boeing catalog didn't have the right aircraft.
The A220 is the perfect example. Boeing didn't have anything in that 100 to 150 seat range with those economics. The 737-700 was close, but it's heavier and burns more fuel. So Delta went with the A220 for those regional routes and kept the 737s for everything else.
So what happens when a new manufacturer tries to break in? Comac in China, Irkut in Russia. They're building aircraft that compete with the 737 and A320. But if the lock-in effects are as strong as we're saying, how does anyone ever switch?
That's the question that's going to define the next decade of the industry. The short answer is, they probably don't switch, not in the established markets. What Comac and Irkut are really competing for is the growth markets. Airlines in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East that are building fleets from scratch and don't have legacy. Boeing or Airbus infrastructure. If you're a new airline in, say, Indonesia, and you need 50 narrowbodies, you're not locked into either ecosystem yet. That's where the new entrants have a shot.
And the established carriers in North America and Europe, they're Boeing or Airbus for the foreseeable future.
Barring some massive disruption, yes. The switching costs are just too high, and the duopoly has gotten very good at making those switching costs structural. It's not just the aircraft, it's the financing, the aftermarket support, the training infrastructure, the relationships with leasing companies. The ecosystem is deep.
So the fleet composition you see on the tarmac is really a fossil record of decisions made decades ago, plus a few strategic additions when the existing ecosystem couldn't cover a new need.
That's a lovely way to put it. The tail logo is a history book.
I want to go back to something you said about the C music system. You mentioned Boeing released flight control computer source code to IAI. That's not a small thing.
It's enormous. The flight control computer is the most sensitive system on a modern airliner. Giving a foreign defense contractor access to that source code is about as deep a trust relationship as exists in the aerospace industry. Airbus has historically been much more reluctant to do that kind of thing. Part of it's corporate culture, part of it's European export control regulations, part of it's that Airbus doesn't have the same decades-long relationship with Israeli defense establishments.
So even if El Al wanted to switch to Airbus tomorrow, Airbus might not let them do the modifications they need.
Or the negotiations would be so protracted and the certification so expensive that it wouldn't make economic sense for a 45-aircraft airline. The math just doesn't work.
Which means El Al is Boeing, not just for historical reasons, but because Boeing is the only manufacturer that's compatible with their security requirements.
I'd say Boeing is the only manufacturer that's made itself compatible. It's not that the aircraft are inherently more modifiable, it's that Boeing has chosen to invest in that relationship, and Airbus hasn't.
That's a much more interesting story than they buy American because Israel is America's ally.
It's the difference between geopolitics as a backdrop and geopolitics as an engineering reality. The alliance matters, but it matters through very specific technical channels. Source code access, certification pathways, engineering relationships, not through some vague sense of loyalty.
So to come back to Daniel's questions, are the largest airlines trending toward standardization or diversification? Diversification, but for reasons that are specific to scale. Why is El Al all Boeing? Because switching would mean recertifying missile defense modifications from scratch on a platform whose manufacturer might not cooperate. How do mixed operators manage the complexity? Through fleet-specific maintenance and training pipelines that only make economic sense above a certain fleet size. And Delta flies Airbus because they inherited the fleet from Northwest and discovered the planes worked better on some routes.
That's the episode in four sentences.
We should probably unpack it for another 20 minutes, though.
That's the job.
One thing we haven't touched on. You mentioned the 737 MAX grounding earlier. That's the counter-argument to standardization, isn't it? If you're all in on one type and that type gets grounded, you have no airplanes.
It's the nightmare scenario. Southwest lost something like 30-plus aircraft worth of capacity when the MAX was grounded, and they had no alternative. They couldn't shift routes to a different type because they didn't have a different type. They just had to cancel flights and wait. A mixed fleet carrier like United could at least shuffle things around, put more 757s on routes that would normally use MAXes, that kind of thing.
So standardization is efficient until it isn't.
It's a bet on the manufacturer not having a catastrophic failure, and most of the time, that bet pays off. When it doesn't, you're in a world of pain.
The other thing I'm curious about, you said Delta's mechanics are certified on specific types. What does that actually look like day to day? If you're a mechanic at Delta's Atlanta hub and you're certified on Airbus widebodies, do you just only touch A30s and A350s?
Basically, yes. The hangars are organized by fleet type. There's a Boeing narrowbody hangar, an Airbus narrowbody hangar, a Boeing widebody hangar, an Airbus widebody hangar. A mechanic shows up to their assigned hangar and works on whatever's there. They don't float between types. The airline maintains separate tooling, separate parts inventories, separate documentation for each hangar.
From the mechanic's perspective, it's almost like working for a smaller, single-type airline. Just one that happens to share a brand with several other single-type airlines.
The complexity lives at the network planning level and the procurement level. At the operational level, Delta has essentially created separate maintenance organizations that operate in parallel. It's expensive, but at 900-plus aircraft, the scale justifies it.
The pilots. You said they're qualified on one family at a time. Can they switch?
They can, but it's a process. If you're a Delta pilot currently flying 737s and you want to move to the A320 family, you go through a full type rating course, several weeks of ground school and simulator training, plus a check ride. The airline pays for it, but you're not productive during that time, so there's a cost to the airline in both training dollars and lost flying hours. Pilots tend to stay on one family for years at a time.
The workforce isn't really mixed, in the sense of individuals working across manufacturers. It's mixed at the airline level, but specialized at the individual level.
That's how you make it work. You don't ask individuals to be experts on everything. You build separate pipelines and let people specialize.
That actually makes the whole thing seem more manageable than I'd assumed.
It's manageable if you're big enough. If you're an airline with 40 aircraft and 4 types, you can't really do that. You don't have enough of each type to justify separate hangars and separate mechanic pools. So your people have to be multi-type qualified, which is expensive and complex, or you have to standardize. Most small airlines standardize.
Which brings us right back to El Al.
Full circle. El Al, with its 45 aircraft, all Boeing, but multiple types within Boeing, 737s, 777s, 787s. That's 3 different type ratings, but they're all within the Boeing ecosystem. The parts supply chain is unified. The manufacturer relationship is unified. The engineering modifications, the missile defense systems, the hardened cockpit doors, the other security features, are all done through the same Boeing IAI pipeline.
The 747s are on their way out.
The 747-400s are being retired, yes. El Al was one of the last passenger operators of the 747, but the 787 is the replacement, still Boeing, still within the same ecosystem.
Even as they modernize, they stay within the fold.
Because the fold isn't just the aircraft. It's the whole modification and certification apparatus that surrounds them. Replacing a 747 with a 787 is straightforward. Same manufacturer, same engineering partners, same regulatory relationships. Replacing a 747 with an A350 would mean rebuilding all of that from the ground up.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned about Delta and the A220. You said Boeing didn't have anything in that size class, but they had the 717, didn't they?
The 717 is an interesting case. Delta does operate 717s. They're the largest operator of the type, but the 717 was originally the McDonnell Douglas MD-95. Boeing inherited it when they merged with McDonnell Douglas in 1997. They built about 150 of them and then shut down production in 2006. So by the time Delta was looking for a 100-seat regional jet, the 707 was out of production and the used market was limited.
Boeing had a gap in their lineup, and Airbus, via the C-Series acquisition, filled it.
Right. And that's the procurement leverage argument in action. Boeing couldn't offer a competitive product in that segment, so Delta went with the A220. If Delta had been an all-Boeing shop, they'd have been stuck with a suboptimal solution, probably 700-700s burning more fuel than they needed to on regional routes.
Which is the argument for not being an all-anything shop?
If you're big enough to afford the complexity, the flexibility is worth it.
One last thing on El Al. You mentioned the C-Music system uses lasers. Is that visible? Do passengers see lasers firing from the wings?
No, it's in the infrared spectrum. Invisible to the naked eye. The system sits in pods mounted under the fuselage. Passengers wouldn't know it's there unless they knew to look for the pods. And El Al doesn't exactly advertise the specifics.
A laser-based missile jammer hidden in plain sight on a passenger jet. That's very Israeli.
It's peak Israeli aerospace engineering. Take a commercial airliner, integrate military-grade countermeasures, make it invisible to passengers, and get it certified by 2 different civil aviation authorities. The fact that it works at all is remarkable.
It works because of a relationship with Boeing that goes back half a century.
That's the part that doesn't make it into the fleet strategy discussions. People assume El Al flies Boeing because of U.S.-Israel politics. The real reason is that Boeing has spent 50 years building an engineering relationship with Israeli defense contractors that Airbus never invested in. The politics enabled it, but the engineering sustains it.
If you're looking at an LAU 787 at Ben Gurion, you're looking at a plane that exists in that exact configuration because of decisions made in the 1970s, sustained by source code access agreements, and justified by the fact that recertifying everything on a different manufacturer's platform would cost more than the airline is worth.
That's about right. The fleet is a fossil, but it's a fossil that's still flying.
The flight guard system on the 767s was worse.
Sorry?
Before C-Music, LAL used a system called Flight Guard, flare-based, not laser, worked by dispensing decoy flares when a missile was detected. The problem was, dispensing pyrotechnic flares off a commercial airliner at low altitude over populated areas, the Europeans had opinions about that.
I'd imagine they did.
Switzerland banned LAL overflights for a while. The Germans weren't thrilled either. The laser system solved that. No pyrotechnics, no falling debris, nothing to complain about. But getting it certified was a nightmare. I was doing avionics integration work for IAI in 2003-2004, contract work, nothing fancy, and the FAA had never certified a directed infrared countermeasure on a civil aircraft before. There was no process. We had to invent the process.
You were working on the C-Music integration?
Flight Guard initially, then the early C-Music work on the 767s and 747s. The certification documents filled 23 binders. The FAA sent a team of 6 people to Tel Aviv for 18 months. It was the most expensive thing I've ever seen. A small airline do.
23 binders.
That was just the FAA submission. The CAAI had their own requirements. Boeing had to release flight control computer source code, the actual code, not just interface specs, to IAI so they could integrate the threat detection logic. That took 2 years of negotiations just for the data release agreement.
Airbus wouldn't do that.
Airbus wouldn't even discuss it. Their position was that the flight control laws were proprietary, and they wouldn't release them to any foreign entity, defense contractor or not. Still is, as far as I know. So the question of whether LAL could switch to Airbus is moot. They can't do the modifications on an Airbus platform. The manufacturer won't allow it.
That's more definitive than I'd realized.
It's not a preference. It's a hard constraint. LAL flies Boeing because Boeing is the only manufacturer that will let them be LAL.
The fleet strategy isn't a strategy at all. It's a requirement.
Always was. The 707s had defensive systems, too, back in the 70s. Simpler then, flares, chaff. But Boeing was already cooperating. Once that relationship existed, the path was set. You don't walk away from a 50-year engineering partnership when the alternative won't even take your phone call.
I'd been framing it as a cost issue. That switching would be prohibitively expensive. But you're saying it's not even possible.
Not with the current modification requirements. If LAL gave up the missile defense systems, which they won't, then Airbus becomes an option. But as long as those systems are on the aircraft, they need a manufacturer that'll share flight control code. That's Boeing and only Boeing.
23 binders.
I still have one. The cover sheet. Framed. It's in a box somewhere.
The next time you're on a plane and you look at the tail, you're not just seeing a brand preference. You're seeing the visible tip of an iceberg made of source code agreements, certification binders, and 50-year engineering relationships.
Sometimes, you're just seeing who gave you the better deal on a Tuesday.
That too. The misconception I think most people carry around is that airlines standardize on one manufacturer because it's always cheaper. But the largest legacy carriers are mixed for a reason. Route-specific economics and procurement leverage outweigh the cost of diversification once you're above a certain scale.
The other misconception, that LAL flies Boeing because of U.S.-Israel political ties. The politics matter, but the real driver is that Boeing shares technical data with Israeli defense contractors and Airbus doesn't. Without that, the missile defense modifications that define LAL's security posture wouldn't be possible.
The open question I'm left with is, what happens when COMAC and Irkut get serious about export markets? If the lock-in effects of the Boeing-Airbus ecosystems are as strong as we've described, do they have any real shot at the established carriers? Or are they fighting for the new entrants in growth markets and hoping that's enough?
My guess is the latter. The switching costs are structural, and the duopoly has spent decades making them deeper. But new airlines and new markets don't carry that baggage. That's where the battle will be fought.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumentop for the 23-binder reality check.
If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone about the show. Word of mouth is how we grow. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.